an individual suffering from Alzheimer's. Otto relies on a notebook to help him remember things. He writes down any new information that he learns, and when he needs to recall something, he consults his notebook. This notebook is always at hand, and he's able to retrieve the information inside it immediately and efficiently. According to Clark and Chalmers, Otto's notebook serves the same purpose as a biological memory. We call things up from memory, while Otto calls things up from his notebook. We keep our beliefs in our minds, while Otto keeps his on paper. Confundus. At first, the extended mind theory may sound like something from a Quibbler story, hatched by Xenophilius Lovegood. If it were described to Ron, I can easily imagine him saying, no pun intended, "That's mental." But it begins to make sense when we distinguish between what philosophers call a current and non-occurrent beliefs. At any given time, the overwhelming majority of a person's beliefs are not consciously available. Ron believes that Ireland won its match against Bulgaria at the 422nd Quidditch World Cup, but presumably, that belief isn't at the forefront of his mind, it's not a current, while he and Hermione are racing to the Chamber of Secrets to retrieve the remaining basilisk fang during the Battle of Hogwarts. At that point, all of his occurrent beliefs most likely concern the great danger of his present situation, the fastest path to Moaning Myrtle's bathroom, and how he's going to manage to say open in parcel tongue, a language he doesn't speak. Similarly, because the information in Otto's notebook isn't in the forefront of his mind, it doesn't seem at all analogous to our occurrent beliefs. Rather, it functions like our non-occurrent beliefs. Consider Rita Skeeter's non-occurrent belief that Batilda Bagshot lives in Godric's Hollow, which is stored somewhere in her memory, waiting to be accessed. When Rita decides to interview Batilda in order to gather material for The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore, she must pause to think for a moment to recall where Batilda lives. It's only then that the belief becomes a current. Likewise, suppose that Otto has his old friend Batilda's address written in his notebook. When he decides to visit her, he has to take a moment to look up in his notebook where she lives. His belief is stored somewhere inside the notebook, waiting to be accessed. Just as it would be silly to deny that even before she consults her memory, Rita has the belief that Batilda lives in Godric's Hollow, we should accept that Otto has the same belief even before he consults his notebook. Clark and Chalmers don't go so far as to claim that every external support we rely on becomes part of the mind. Rather, they see something special in Otto's connection to his notebook. It's not the same as Harry's reliance on the marginal notes of the Half-Blood Prince in the potions textbook he borrows from Horace Slughorn, or Neville Longbottom's dependence on a handwritten list to help him remember the frequently changing passwords when Sir Cadogan substitutes for the Fat Lady in guarding the entrance to the Gryffindor common room. Harry's use of the textbook and Neville's use of the list both occur only sporadically, and Neville even ends up losing his list. Otto's connection to his notebook is not even like Hermione Granger's reliance on Hogwarts or history. Although Hermione consults the book regularly, and even ends up bringing it along on the search for Voldemort's Horcruxes because she wouldn't feel right if she didn't have it with her, the information in the book seems more like a supplement to the information in her mind, rather than an extension of her mind. What makes Otto's notebook different from these and other ordinary cases is the way it's integrated into his daily functioning. Even though the information kept in the notebook is external to his body, he always has his notebook with him, and he always consults it when trying to recall information. When using his notebook, he immediately accepts the information within it. There are no deep respects in which the information in the notebook is different from the information in our memories, except for the fact that it's stored outside the boundaries of Otto's skull and skin. According to Clark and Chalmers, that one difference alone isn't enough to keep the information in Otto's notebook from being part of his mind. Mischief managed. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that we accept the extended mind idea. Now consider Fred and George Weasley's connection to the Marauder's map they stole from Argus Filch's office in their first year at Hogwarts. Until they later bequeath it to Harry, they rely on it so heavily in their escapades that it wouldn't be much of a stretch to see their relationship to it as analogous to Otto's relationship to his notebook. The problem, however, is that there are two of them. If the map becomes not only part of Fred's extended mind, but also part of George's extended mind, then the twins share even more in common than we'd realized. Their minds actually overlap. This suggests one of the potentially disturbing ramifications of the extended mind idea. Once we accept that the minds extend beyond the boundaries of skin and skull, we open up the possibility that it extends into someone else's mind. When this overlap occurs, we don't need to be skilled at legilimency to have the ability to extract thoughts from another person's mind. Those thoughts may already be part of our own. A related worry is the potential threat that an extended mind poses to one's sense of self. Compared to the ordeals that Harry Potter has to endure and the greatness he achieves in spite of them, both the trials and the triumphs experienced by most witches and wizards, and certainly most muggles and squibs, seem trivial. But just as Harry's experiences make him the person he is, the personal experiences that each of us undergoes make us who we are. Many philosophers endorse some version of the memory theory of personal identity, which dates back at least to the British philosopher John Locke, 1632 to 1704. According to this theory, our continuing identity over time consists in the continuity of memory. It's the chains of memory connecting them that makes the adult Harry who watches his children board the Hogwarts Express the same person as the teenager who faces Voldemort in the Forbidden Forest, and the same person as the orphaned infant taken in by the Dursleys. According to the memory theory, our memories are at the very foundations of our identities. If these same memories can be shared with someone else, and can even become part of someone else, then how do we know who we really are? At various times during his Hogwarts career, Harry shares the memories of several other individuals, including three of his professors, Dumbledore, Snape, and Slughorn. And indeed, in almost every instance, he is greatly affected by his forays into the Pensieve. Tortured by the look he got via Snape's memory of his own father's arrogant and unappealing behaviour while at Hogwarts, Harry reevaluates not only his sense of his father, but also his sense of himself. For nearly 5 years, the thought of his father had been a source of comfort, of inspiration. Whenever someone had told him he was like James, he had glowed with pride inside. And now he felt cold and miserable at the thought of him. When he learns, again from Snape's memory, that a part of Voldemort's soul lives within himself, he's forced to reshape his sense of his place in the world. Finally, the truth. Harry understood at last that he was not supposed to survive. In each of these cases, Harry's use of the Pensieve leads to a sort of identity crisis. But now, think about what else can happen in the wizarding world. Physical appearance can be replicated via Polyjuice Potion. Memories can be almost completely erased by a flick of the wand and an incantation of Obliviate. False memories can also be implanted. Each of these magical possibilities poses a great threat to the integrity of an individual's identity, much greater, in fact, than the threat of memory sharing via Pensieve. When Barty Crouch Jr. imprisons Moody in a trunk and uses Polyjuice Potion to impersonate him, he's really engaged in identity theft. Gilderoy Lockhart steals countless identities via memory charms before becoming his own victim through his use of a malfunctioning wand. Hermione has much purer motives when she tampers with her parents' memories, making them believe that they're Wendell and Monica Wilkins, a childless couple fulfilling their lifelong dream of moving to Australia. But her good intentions don't change the fact that her actions deprive the Grangers of their identities. Clearly, Harry's experiences with the Pensieve don't fall into this same category. What makes his previous experiences with the Pensieve so difficult is the content of the memories he shared, not the memory sharing itself. Seeing Snape's worst memory is an unpleasant experience for Harry because of the painful facts it reveals, not because it somehow causes his identity to merge with that of the potions master. Had Snape been a good storyteller, and had Harry been able to trust him, the same awful knowledge that Harry gains from the Pensieve could theoretically have been gained from an oral recounting. Using the pensieve is more effective because it allows Harry to see the past events for himself, and is more objective because Snape's own testimony would probably be tinged with sneering subjectivity. But in principle, any knowledge conveyed via the pensieve could be conveyed another way. Lumos. There are several different sorts of memories. Some are know-how memories, memories of skill, as when an aging wizard who hasn't used a broomstick since his Quidditch days remembers how to ride it. Some are factual memories, as when Hermione can report the properties of the mandrake during herbology. Distinct from both of these are experiential memories, memories from the first-person point of view, as when Harry remembers the searing pain caused by Dolores Umbridge's quill as it carved words into his right hand. The memories that Otto keeps in his notebook are factual memories. When memory theorists invoke memory and explanations of personal identity, however, they're interested in first-person, experiential memories. It is important to note that memories reviewed in a pensieve are not of this sort. The pensieve replays memories from the third-person perspective. When Dumbledore thinks about the trial and sentencing of Bellatrix Lestrange, his memory is presumably from the personal perspective he had on it at the time, from his seat on the highest bench in the gallery of spectators. But when he reviews the memory in the pensieve, the memory no longer has this or any particular point of view. In fact, given what we know about the pensieve, the memory that Dumbledore shares with Harry should already be shared by all of the spectators at Lestrange's trial. These facts about the pensieve are crucial for understanding why its use poses no threat to our individual identities. What's important for personal identity are our first-person memories. Just as using a time-turner to revisit past events doesn't jeopardize who you are, neither does sharing memories via a pensieve. And just as sharing an experience with someone else doesn't threaten your sense of self, sharing one of your memories in a pensieve with someone else shouldn't either. This also sheds light, more broadly, on why we needn't be threatened by the thesis of the extended mind. The mind is indeed mysterious, and there's much about it we don't know. But one thing that we can be sure of is that whether your thoughts are kept in a pensieve, in a mind, or in your notebook, those thoughts are still your own. The pensieve is a truly magical device, and if I ever see one come up for auction on eBay, I'll bid on it without hesitation or limit. Still, however magical it is, it can't make you someone you're not. Chapter 15. A Hogwarts Education. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Gregory Basham. What kid wouldn't love to go to Hogwarts? Boarding school in a really cool castle, tons of adventures, great camaraderie, and a sense of belonging. Wonderful all-you-can-eat meals, roast beef, roast chicken, pork chops and lamb chops, sausages, bacon and steak, boiled potatoes, roast potatoes, fries, Yorkshire pudding. And best of all, no boring math, French or science classes. Pretty much all you learn is how to do magic. You learn how to fly, to travel instantly from point to point, to conjure things out of thin air, to transfigure objects into whatever you want them to be, to make potions that cure diseases or bring good luck, to defend yourself against dark wizards, creepy dementors, and obnoxious gits like Draco Malfoy. Heck, Hogwarts is like a camp for future superheroes. From a kid's point of view, what could be cooler? What seems cool to a kid, though, may not seem so swift to an adult or to a philosopher. What would great educational thinkers, philosophers such as Plato, Aristotle, Kant and John Dewey, say about teaching and learning at Hogwarts? Is Hogwarts a model school, as Susan Engel, the director of the program in teaching at Williams College, has claimed? Or are there real problems with Hogwarts academics that need to be addressed? Here, we'll look at the pros and cons of a Hogwarts education through the lenses of both classic philosophers of education and contemporary educational research. The good. The philosopher John Dewey, 1859 to 1952, was the most influential thinker in American education. Early in the 20th century, Dewey criticized traditional education for its stress on passive listening, rote memorization, undemocratic values, and disconnect with practical real-life concerns. In opposition to traditional education, Dewey advocated a progressive approach to teaching and learning that emphasized three features that have now been widely adopted in American education: hands-on learning, building on the natural interests of children, and connecting schoolwork to everyday life. One of the clear strengths of education at Hogwarts is that it reflects these three progressivist ideals. Hands-on learning. As we've seen, kids don't come to Hogwarts to learn calculus or Spanish or world history. They come to learn how to do magic. And by this yardstick, Hogwarts is clearly a successful school. Most of its students do learn loads of useful potions and spells, pass their owls and newts, and graduate as capable magicians. How do students learn so effectively? Not through listening to Professor Binns's boring lectures on the history of magic, or by reading Professor Umbridge's purely theoretical textbook assignments. Instead, they learn to do magic in an apprentice-like way that typically involves 1. Demonstration of a magical technique by a skilled teacher. 2. Practice of the technique by the students. 3. Individualized coaching by the instructor to correct faults. And 4. Continued practice by the students until the technique is mastered. Nearly all of the examples of effective pedagogy in the Potter books, for instance, Remus Lupin's teaching Harry how to conjure a Patronus, or Harry's teaching of defensive magic to Dumbledore's army, involve this kind of hands-on learning by doing. Given that magic is portrayed in the Potter series as a hard-to-acquire skill that can be mastered only through coaching and practice, this kind of teaching makes perfect sense. Building on the natural interests of children. Dewey believed that children are naturally active and curious, and he urged educators to use kids' natural interests and real-life experiences as hooks to encourage learning. Research has shown that students are more engaged and learn more when they study things they find interesting and relevant. Hogwarts students are clearly eager to learn magic. They love having magical abilities and enjoy developing those abilities and learning new spells and skills. Moreover, they clearly understand the practical value of what they're learning. When Umbridge won't allow her Defense Against the Dark Arts students to practice defensive magic, the pupils organize their own class to practice on their own. They know that learning to do defensive magic is vital to their success on school exams, in their lives and careers after Hogwarts, and to their efforts as part of Dumbledore's army to thwart Voldemort's return to power. Connecting schoolwork to everyday life. Too often, Dewey believed, classwork is seen as a preparation for some remote and speculative future, rather than as a part of life itself. Learning the names of Uruguay's three largest rivers might be useful to some pupils, for example, if they plan to open a tugboat business there someday. But for most students, this information will be what the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, 1861 to 1947, called inert knowledge, lumps of undigested, untested, unused information. Dewey believed that education has a practical function and should not be seen as a series of pointless hurdles to jump over before real life begins. Education isn't a preamble to life, it's part of life, and it exists to solve practical human problems and meet human needs. Some of what students learn at Hogwarts is pretty inert. For example, Harry and his friends can't see much point in Rubius Hagrid's lesson on raising ugly and dangerous blast-ended scroots, or Professor Trelawney's bogus crystal ball-gazing. But generally, students can recognize right away the practical payoff of what they're learning. They realize that when they leave Hogwarts, they will need to know how to apparate and disapparate, to transfigure objects, to defend themselves against dark wizards, and so forth. This makes them eager students and motivates them to learn. The bad. What's not to love about Hogwarts? As we've seen, the three real strengths of a Hogwarts education are that it encourages hands-on learning, builds on the natural interests of students, and teaches important real-life skills. There are other features of Hogwarts academics, however, that are not so attractive. three major negatives are: the school is too dangerous, there are too few qualified teachers, students don't get a well-rounded education. Let's look at these points one by one. Too dangerous. Let's face it, Hogwarts is a pretty hazardous place to go to school. It's located next to a magical forest where unwary or reckless students may get eaten by giant spiders or set upon by hostile centaurs. There's an ice-cold lake next to the castle full of treacherous water demons, Grindylows, and a giant squid. All kinds of lethal creatures, three-headed dogs, trolls, basilisks, maybe on occasion be found in the school. There's a mischievous resident poltergeist, Peeves, who's constantly trying to trip students up or drop heavy objects onto their heads. Staircases contain vanishing steps that students need to remember to jump over. Unmindful students wandering near the Forbidden Forest may be pounded to a pulp by the Whomping Willow. Students sometimes work with dangerous magical creatures. Professor Kettleburn retires at the end of Harry's second year in order to spend more time with his remaining limbs. Potions often go awry and injure or disfigure students. The most popular game at Hogwarts, Quidditch, can easily result in serious injuries to players. The Triwizard Tournament involves three high-risk challenges, and even the youngest students carry potentially lethal weapons, wands, that they regularly use to hex and jinx one another. True, many injuries that students suffer at Hogwarts can be healed quickly by Severus Snape's potions or Madame Pomfrey's skilled nursing care, but not all injuries can be cured, or cured quickly, by magical means. And as Albus Dumbledore says, no magic can reawaken the dead. Granted, the Potter books are only fiction, and all of this danger and violence makes for exciting stories. But you can bet that if Hogwarts really existed, the WTA, Wizard Teacher Association, would be up in arms. Unqualified teachers. Hogwarts teachers are a mixed bag. There are good teachers who are competent, caring and fair. These include Albus Dumbledore, Minerva McGonagall, Phileas Fitwick, Pomona Sprout, and Remus Lupin. Other teachers are fairly decent, but have significant shortcomings. These include Hagrid, who is knowledgeable and engaging, but can't resist exposing his students to dangerous creatures. Moody Crouch, who teaches his students loads, but unfortunately, as Dean Thomas notes, turns out to be a disguised homicidal maniac. And Snape, who certainly knows his stuff, but is bullying, sarcastic, and blatantly biased in favour of Slytherin students. There are also downright crummy teachers at Hogwarts. The four worst, if you don't count the Death Eaters who briefly join the faculty in Deathly Hallows, are Binns, Sybil Trelawney, Gilderoy Lockhart, and Dolores Umbridge. Binns, a ghost, who apparently doesn't know that he's dead, regularly puts his History of Magic students to sleep with his droning lectures, doesn't know the names of his pupils, and is barely aware that there are actually any students in his classes. Trelawney is an old fraud who teaches a woolly subject, divination, and enjoys predicting her students' early and gruesome deaths. Lockhart is a narcissistic and ineffectual blowhard. And Umbridge, of course, is a twisted, power-hungry racial supremacist who tries to undermine any effective education at the school. Dumbledore has great difficulties hiring qualified faculty at Hogwarts. Mostly, this isn't his fault. After Professor Quirrell's shocking demise, we're told that no one would take the job of Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher, except the hapless Lockhart. Yet the larger problem, as Arthur E. Levine notes, is that the wizarding world has no teacher education programmes or certification requirements. Apparently, anybody can teach at Hogwarts, including those with little or no formal magical education, such as Fiorenzi or Hagrid. Without effective teacher training and credentialing procedures, teacher quality at the Wizarding School is bound to be sketchy and even pose risks to students. No well-rounded education. If Harry and his friends were attending a Muggle British boarding school, they would have classes in subjects such as English, history, science, geography, music, mathematics, foreign languages, physical education, citizenship, and religious education. At Hogwarts, the only thing students learn is how to do magic. Why is this a problem? Because Hogwarts offers a narrow and vocationally oriented education. It provides its students with the tools of power, but not the wisdom to use them. As the noted philosopher of education, Mortimer Adler, 1902 to 2001, remarked, a good secondary school should prepare its students to do three things: to earn a living in an intelligent and responsible fashion, to function as intelligent and responsible citizens, and to make both of these things serve the purpose of leading intelligent and responsible lives, to enjoy as fully as possible all the goods that make a human life as good as it can be. Hogwarts is devoted almost exclusively to the first of these three goals, vocational training. It teaches its students how to make a living in the wizarding world, but not how to live. What is the aim of education? Great educational thinkers have defended various views. For Plato, the first great philosopher of education in Western civilization, the purpose of education is to achieve wisdom, goodness, and a just and well-ordered society. For Plato's pupil Aristotle, education should promote human fulfillment, eudaimonia, which he defined as a life filled with intrinsically excellent activities, especially purely intellectual activities. John Locke, 1632 to 1704, claimed that virtue and wisdom are the great business of education. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712 to 1778, advocated a natural, child-centered education aimed at producing happy, virtuous citizens, uncorrupted by the hypocrisies and false values of civilization. Immanuel Kant believed that character development, becoming a good moral person who wills the right things for the right reasons, is the primary aim of education. Even John Dewey, who, as we've seen, criticized traditional education for its disconnect with real-world concerns, argued that the ultimate aim of education is simply more education or growth in one's capacity for enriching experiences. An educated person should be able to write and speak well, think critically, and be well grounded in the sciences and the humanities that form the foundation of a liberal education. The goal of a liberal education is not to help students get a good job, but to impart the knowledge, skills, and dispositions needed to fulfill one's human potential, to understand and appreciate the supreme productions of human thought and art, and to live a rich, full, and vibrant life. A good secondary school should lay the foundation for such a liberal education. Above all, as Adler noted, it should seek to impart to its students both the skills of learning and the wish to learn, so that in adult life they will want to go on learning and will have the skills to use in the process. Because there are no universities in the wizarding world, it is critical that secondary wizarding schools, such as Hogwarts, encourage and equip their students to become lifelong learners. Yet Hogwarts clearly fails in this regard. At Hogwarts, Harry and his friends are taught how to perform spells and brew potions. They are not taught to love reading or ideas, to think scientifically, to appreciate art and literature, or to reflect in an informed and disciplined way about the problems of society and the human condition. Of course, not all education at a residential school like Hogwarts takes place in the classroom, and Harry and his friends learn many important life lessons outside formal class settings. In fact, Harry's most important teacher and role model at Hogwarts is clearly Dumbledore, although he isn't one of Harry's regular instructors. For Harry, Ron Weasley, Hermione Granger, Neville Longbottom, Ginny Weasley, Luna Lovegood, and their circle, Hogwarts does prove to be a kind of school of virtue of the sort that ancient philosophers praised. In assessing the value of a Hogwarts education, it's important to keep in mind what is learned both inside and outside the classroom. My point is simply that Hogwarts' formal curriculum is too narrow and vocational. Remember that most Hogwarts students have relatively little contact with Dumbledore during their years at the school. Harry may pick up priceless nuggets of wisdom in Dumbledore's office, but for most Hogwarts students, it's what they learn, or fail to learn, in the classroom that makes the greatest difference in their lives. Some might argue that people with magical powers don't really need a well-rounded liberal education, that they can find happiness and achieve their life goals without one. Besides, they might say, Any serious misuse of magic will likely be detected and severely punished by the Ministry of Magic. This misses the point of a liberal education, however. A liberal education is one suited to a free individual. It liberates the mind by enlarging its perspective, refining its sensibilities, and freeing it from ignorance and the limitations of one's time, place, and culture. As Adler said, a proper education cultivates a person's capability for mental growth and moral development, and helps her acquire the intellectual and moral virtues requisite for a good human life. The Hogwarts curriculum is not well suited to provide the broad-based knowledge, the intellectual skills, and the solid character virtues that a good school, wizarding or muggle, should seek to impart. Because of the narrow vocational education they receive, Hogwarts students are ill-equipped to deal with the many problems that confront wizarding society, including, as Hermione says, this horrible thing wizards have of thinking they're superior to other creatures. The ugly. This horrible thing is, in fact, the greatest problem wizards face. The Potter books are a morality tale about a wizard civil war. On one side, are Voldemort's racial supremacists, who want wizards to rule over muggles, and pure-blooded wizards to rule over those of mixed ancestry. On the other side, are Dumbledore and those who reject such radical supremacist views, and believe instead in the basic equality of all rational, or at least all human, creatures on Earth. I say this is the biggest problem wizards face, not only because of the repulsiveness of such racial elitism, but because of what is at stake. Totalitarianism, thought control, secret police, mock trials, racial cleansing, all are real possibilities if the supremacists win. And of course, they nearly do win in the Potter books, just as the Nazis nearly won in World War II. So, what is Dumbledore doing to educate Hogwarts students about the dangers and the irrationality of racial supremacism? Not a heck of a lot, at least not directly. True, Hogwarts is open to all students with magical powers, regardless of ancestry, race or social class, and Dumbledore makes a point of being an equal opportunity employer, hiring half-bloods such as Snape, and members of marginalised groups such as half-giants Hagrid, centaurs, Firenze, and werewolves, Lupin. But that's about it. There are, so far as we are told, no class discussions on racism, no workshops, no school assemblies on the topic. Racial slurs are rampant at Hogwarts, but no student is ever disciplined for using one. The fact that Hogwarts houses the largest population of oppressed house elves in England is nowhere mentioned in the 1,000 pages of Hogwarts: A History, and Hermione's efforts to alleviate the house elves' plight are given no public support from Dumbledore. Most seriously, Dumbledore does nothing to remedy the great festering source of militant pure-bloodism at Hogwarts, Slytherin House. Slytherin is a breeding ground for dark wizards. As Hagrid says, when Voldemort rose to power, there wasn't a single witch or wizard who went bad who wasn't in Slytherin. And this is no accident. Students are sorted into Slytherin because they will use any means to achieve their ends. Because people, especially impressionable children, tend to become like those they associate with, Slytherin is a hothouse of racial intolerance. It is also, inevitably, a source of fifth columnists in Hogwarts, students whose ultimate loyalties aren't to Dumbledore or their classmates, but to Voldemort and his warped racist agenda. This cancer of racial intolerance and elitism is what is ugly about education at Hogwarts. The obvious question is why Dumbledore doesn't do more about it. In one sense, of course, he does do something hugely important about it. He works tirelessly and courageously to defeat Voldemort. But Voldemort was powerless for more than a decade after his failed attempt to kill Harry. Why didn't Dumbledore do anything to address the problems with Slytherin then? Maybe Dumbledore's hands were tied by school bylaws, or the tradition-bound Hogwarts Board of Governors. Maybe he would have been fired if he had tried to take decisive action. Maybe, as Travis Prinzi argues, he was a libertarian gradualist who believed in changing hearts and minds by personal example and gentle persuasion, rather than by coercive rules or policies. Who knows? There could be lots of reasons he refuses to take stronger action. I, for one, am happy to give him the benefit of the doubt. But it's a fair question, I think, whether Dumbledore shouldn't have done more than he did. Like Bertie Bott's Every Flavour Beans, a mix. Hogwarts, like most schools, has its pros and cons. Its students love the castle, the grounds, the camaraderie, the hands-on focus on practical magic. It's definitely a fun and interesting place to go to school, yet there are also a few big negatives about a Hogwarts education, including some ineffective teachers, a dangerous environment, a narrow curriculum, and a strong undercurrent of racial intolerance and elitism. So, would I send my kid to Hogwarts? In the final analysis, yes. It's just too special an opportunity to miss. But I'd also be sure, as I do, to teach my child about the fundamental equality of persons, the vital role of democratic freedoms, and the importance of a well-rounded education. For these are the values that can make our world a truly magical place. Part 5. Beyond the Veil. Death, Hope, and Meaning. Chapter 16. The Real Secret of the Phoenix. Moral Regeneration Through Death. Charles Taliaferro. The phoenix is a majestic mythical bird that has the power to ignite in flames and then be reborn from its ashes. This power to be reborn through death might simply be part of the magical background to J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter stories, or it might be something more. As part of that background, Dumbledore's phoenix, Fawkes, plays a brave and noble role in protecting Harry in the Chamber of Secrets and in shielding Dumbledore in the battle at the Ministry of Magic by taking a killing curse. The key opposition to Voldemort is called the Order of the Phoenix, but such references might simply be there to enrich the plot. Yet the magical power of the phoenix may be a clue to a deep theme about the nature of relationships that philosophers have addressed. Some philosophers propose that something similar to the process of death and rebirth of the phoenix is necessary in mending relationships through a process of remorse, seeking forgiveness, and then developing a new, reformed character. The basic idea is that the person who has committed a serious wrong needs to confess what he has done, express sincere remorse, repudiate any pleasure or gain that he got from the wrongdoing, and form radically new intentions and desires that make any future wrongdoing unthinkable, or at least unlikely. The act of repudiating the past wrong and any illicit pleasure has been understood by some philosophers as a kind of death. One burns up or dies to the self who committed the wrong. The reformed person emerges from this process of repudiation and remorse as an essentially new person. Continuity is maintained. The new person emerges from the one who did the wrong. But there is still a radically new self on the other side of this massive shift from bad to good, from evil desires to new good intentions and resolutions. This model faces some objections. We will consider two major ones at the end of the chapter, but it has much intuitive appeal. In a friendship broken by betrayal, it seems that the chief road to reconciliation has to involve remorse. The person has to be genuinely sorry about betraying you, and once there has been evident reform, there has to be a genuine acceptance of the person back again into friendship. Sure, both of you might never forget the fact that a betrayal took place, but don't you both have to put aside any ongoing blame? You can't have a very good renewed friendship if every other day you remind the person that she or he did wrong. In effect, the repaired relationship has to be reborn. You have accepted the return of your friend and see her or him in a new light, setting to one side resentment or focus on past injury. This portrait of moral repair as a kind of death and rebirth is found most famously in some religious traditions, especially in Christianity, where the transition from sin to life in God is described as dying and rising to a new life. Romans 5. The Christian rite of baptism is traditionally seen as a kind of death to sin and rebirth into the household of God, in which the redeemed soul may even take on a new name. Secular contemporary accounts of moral reform have also taken seriously the way in which repentance requires a clear departure from the self that did the wrong and an identification of the reformed person with a new set of desires and essentially a new identity. In this chapter, we'll explore the ways in which this model may be seen in the work of J.K. Rowling, with a focus on the Deathly Hallows. As we'll see, Rowling actually goes further than most philosophers have in illuminating the process of moving to new life through a kind of death, by juxtaposing Harry and Dumbledore on the one hand and Lord Voldemort on the other. Voldemort provides a fascinating inversion, or really a perversion of the process of moving from death to life. Voldemort spreads death by clinging to life, whereas Dumbledore and Harry move to a deeper life by accepting death. Remorse and death. In their final confrontation, Harry gives Voldemort a last chance, a possible reprieve. That reprieve must involve remorse. In Harry's invitation to challenge to feel remorse, Harry does not use the title Voldemort, he who must not be named, or the Dark Lord, but instead his given name, Tom Riddle. Harry seems to be calling Riddle back from his role as a menacing, almost supernatural Dark Lord, to take ownership of himself as Tom Riddle, the confused, angry, but highly promising child. The process that one who calls himself Voldemort would have to undergo to admit and feel remorse for his sordid, ugly crimes as Tom Riddle is too deflationary for the Dark Lord. In other words, Riddle needs to shed or die to his past evil intentions and acts. Unwilling to undergo such repudiation and humility, Riddle as Voldemort attacks Harry and is undone. Remorse is a key element in the process of reform and regeneration in the Potter stories. Remorse and sorrow, as well as regret. The difference between reform and regret is perhaps most apparent when Voldemort commands his snake to kill Severus Snape. After giving the command kill to Nagini, Voldemort has this reaction. "I regret it," said Voldemort coldly. He turned away. There was no sadness in him, no remorse. It was time to leave the shack and take charge with a wand that would now do his full bidding. He pointed it at the starry cage holding the snake, which drifted upward off Snape, who fell sideways onto the floor, blood gushing from the wounds in his neck. Voldemort swept from the room without a backward glance, and the great serpent floated after him in its huge protective sphere. Regret involves sorrow or displeasure that some event has occurred, but remorse adds a crucial ingredient, a feeling of profound sorrow that one has committed the act. Regret need not involve any personal acknowledgement of guilt or personal accountability, but remorse implies grief or sorrow over one's role in some past act or omission. Perhaps Riddle could not begin to feel remorse because he had become so identified with Voldemort, or rather, Riddle had become Voldemort, the wielder of indomitable power, so that he could not see any new life beyond Voldemort through remorse. If one has committed wrong, and all that one feels is remorse for the deed, one is in an almost intolerable position. Moral reform requires that a person proceed to some positive new identity, passing through remorse to a new life. Dumbledore comes to realize that he needs to pass through death when he recognizes his disastrous mistake of putting on the ring with the goal of using the Resurrection Stone. His error was not motivated by evil or spite. He even thought that he might in some way bring about new life through the stone, as Dumbledore confesses to Harry. "When I discovered it, after all those years, buried in the abandoned home of the Gaunts, the Hallow I had craved most of all, though in my youth I had wanted it for very different reasons, I lost my head, Harry. I quite forgot that it was now a Horcrux, that the ring was sure to carry a curse. I picked it up, and I put it on, and for a second I imagined that I was about to see Ariana, and my mother, and my father, and to tell them how very, very sorry I was. I was such a fool, Harry. After all those years I had learned nothing. I was unworthy to unite the Deathly Hallows. I had proved it time and again. And here was final proof." Dumbledore realizes his wrong and is aware that this rash deed has released a poison into his system that will be his complete undoing, despite Snape's best attempts to contain the damage caused by the curse. Dumbledore elects to work through this remorseful recognition of a wrong in order to protect Harry and to provide a path for Voldemort's ultimate defeat. By arranging for Snape to kill him using Avada Kedavra, he sacrifices his life and indirectly saves Draco Malfoy's, dying, as it were, to his past self. This moving beyond his past is evident in the dialogue between Harry and Dumbledore after Harry's apparent death. Dumbledore fully discloses his plans and intentions, displaying through tears his position as a vulnerable professor and guardian who has, in his view, failed in his tasks. Dumbledore also painfully confesses his weaknesses as a young man with his parents, sister, and brother.
I was gifted. I was brilliant. I wanted to escape. I wanted to shine. I wanted glory. Do not misunderstand me,
he said, and pain crossed the face so that he looked ancient again.
I loved them. I loved my parents. I loved my brother and my sister. But I was selfish, Harry, more selfish than you, who are a remarkably selfless person, could possibly imagine.
It is partly through this dialogue and through Harry's own passage from death to life that Dumbledore and Harry are reconciled. In the first few books of the Potter series, Dumbledore is a mentor, a father figure like Merlin or Gandalf. He is a teacher and a professor, a headmaster and a half-guardian to Harry, the embodiment of all that is good and chivalric and noble. By the end of the series, we see another side of Dumbledore. We learn that he is a penitent who feels bound to confess his own shortcomings to Harry in the course of giving him the final, vital instruction that he needs to complete his coming of age. Dumbledore concludes by offering Harry this very Socratic-sounding advice.
You are the true master of death, because the true master does not seek to run away from death. He accepts that he must die, and understands that there are far, far worse things in the living world than dying.
The completion of Harry's great trial, his education or formation, which culminates in his combat with Voldemort, makes peers of Harry and Dumbledore in the end. The exchange between Harry and his mentor, which occurs through the portrait of Dumbledore, suggests that their relationship has changed. They are no longer mentor and mentee. A kind of equality is achieved in their reconciliation and in Harry's victory and resolutions. After Harry told Dumbledore of his plans for the Elder Wand, Dumbledore nodded. They smiled at each other. Harry must undergo a death and a rebirth in order to achieve the full integrity that is necessary for his healing and renewal. When Harry was attacked as a child and the killing curse rebounded, a piece of Voldemort's soul attached itself to Harry, thus allowing Harry insight into Voldemort's mind, giving him the ability to speak Parseltongue, and making the Sorting Hat think he might do well in Slytherin. Voldemort's attack left an indelible mark on Harry's forehead that linked him to Voldemort's mind. At times, this bordered on possession, as in the climactic scene in Order of the Phoenix when Voldemort speaks through Harry. And then Harry's scar burst open. He knew he was dead. It was pain beyond imagining, pain past endurance. He was gone from the hall. He was locked in the coils of a creature with red eyes, so tightly bound that Harry did not know where his body ended and the creature's began. They were fused together, bound by pain, and there was no escape. And when the creature spoke, it used Harry's mouth, so that in his agony he felt his jaw move.
Kill me now, Dumbledore.
To overcome this horrifying link with the Dark Lord, Harry needed the piece of Voldemort's soul that was inside him to die, as occurs near the end of Deathly Hallows, when Harry allows Voldemort to perform the killing curse on him. All is explained in the following conversation as Dumbledore reassures Harry that Harry is not, as he initially believed, dead.
I let him kill me, said Harry. Didn't I?
You did, said Dumbledore, nodding. Go on.
So the part of his soul that was in me.
Dumbledore nodded, still more enthusiastically, urging Harry onward, a broad smile of encouragement on his face.
Has it gone?
Oh, yes, said Dumbledore. Yes, he destroyed it. Your soul is whole and completely your own, Harry.
A little later on in the conversation, Dumbledore elaborates.
You were the seventh Horcrux, Harry. The Horcrux he never meant to make. He had rendered his soul so unstable that it broke apart when he committed those acts of unspeakable evil, the murder of your parents, the attempted killing of a child. But what escaped from that room was even less than he knew. He left more than his body behind. He left part of himself latched to you, the would-be victim who had survived.
To become whole once again, Harry must die to release the Voldemort link. While this dramatic case of dying and rising involves Harry ridding himself of that which is fundamentally foreign to his true identity or core values, there is a sense in every book in which Harry undergoes a process of remorse and regenerating with respect to his own feelings and faults. So, for example, in Order of the Phoenix, his mistrust of Hermione Granger and Ron Weasley needs to be redressed. But before he knew it, Harry was shouting,
"So, you haven't been in the meetings, big deal! You've still been here, haven't you? You've still been together! Me, I've been stuck at the Dursleys for a month, and I've handled more than you two have ever managed, and Dumbledore knows it. Who saved the Sorcerer's Stone? Who got rid of Riddle? Who saved both your skins from the Dementors?"
Every bitter and resentful thought that Harry had had in the past month was pouring out of him. His frustration at the lack of news, the hurt that they had all been together without him, his fury at being followed and not told about it, all the feelings he was half ashamed of finally burst their boundaries. Harry has to renounce his temper and his rash decisions, and there is a recurring sense in which love has a role in solidifying his continuous development, his rebirth, as it were. So, for example, when he and Ginny Weasley kiss after a long separation, this is described in terms of Harry's sense of reality.
"There's the silver lining I've been looking for," she whispered.
And then she was kissing him, as she had never kissed him before, and Harry was kissing her back. And it was blissful oblivion, better than fire whiskey. She was the only real thing in the world. Ginny, the feel of her, one hand at her back and one in her long, sweet-smelling hair. Harry's love for others and their love for him is the foundation for his maturation and his protection from Voldemort. As Dumbledore observes,
"That power of love also saved you from possession by Voldemort, because he could not bear to reside in a body so full of the force he detests."
The inversion of Voldemort. As Voldemort, Tom Riddle displays almost the exact opposite pattern of development as do Harry and Dumbledore. Rather than feeling remorse, repentance and renewal with each murder, Voldemort more deeply takes ownership of his identity as a murderer and a tyrant, one who sees his life as infinitely more important and interesting than the lives around him. Voldemort's pursuit of eternal life, in a sort of perverse inversion of the Christian ideal of life through dying to self, leads him to a form of self-division in which he divides his soul into seven, unwittingly eight, parts.
"The more I've read about Horcruxes," said Hermione, "the more horrible they seem, and the less I can believe that he actually made six. It warns in this book, Secrets of the Darkest Art, how unstable you make the rest of your soul by ripping it, and that's just by making one Horcrux."
Harry remembered what Dumbledore had said about Voldemort moving beyond usual evil.
"Isn't there any way of putting yourself back together?" Ron asked.
"Yes," said Hermione with a hollow smile. "But it would be excruciatingly painful."
"Why? How do you do it?" asked Harry.
"Remorse," said Hermione. "You've got to really feel what you've done. There's a footnote. Apparently the pain of it can destroy you. I can't see Voldemort attempting it somehow, can you?"
The Horcrux embodiments of Voldemort's soul become the repositories of vile malice. Each must be destroyed to finally defeat the Dark Lord. Notice the inversion here. Remorse and rebirth serve to foster a deeper, more natural life for Harry and Dumbledore, whereas Voldemort's pursuit of evil makes him increasingly unnatural. For example, friendship between Harry and his mates and his interaction with Dumbledore often involve eating, or really feasting, games and affectionate exchanges of gifts. With Voldemort, there is no feasting, but, most perversely, the drinking of blood. Rather than Voldemort's action leading to fullness of life, his evil acts threaten his natural embodiment. When he tried to kill the infant Harry, his evil act seemed to vaporize him, turning him into a mist, a disembodied being. He pointed the wand very carefully into the boy's face.
Avada Kedavra!
And then he broke. He was nothing, nothing but pain and terror, and he must hide himself, not here in the rubble of the ruined house, where the child was trapped and screaming, but far away, far away. Until Voldemort can become re-embodied, his life is parasitic on the blood and the limbs of others. He needs Harry's blood and Wormtail's hand to regenerate a full-grown body. In the final volume, Voldemort's body doesn't seem to be natural. His face is snake-like, and he's able to fly without the aid of a broomstick or other magical means. The contrast with the world of Dumbledore and Harry and his friends could not be more radical, with its real eating and authentic affectionate touch. At the end of the book, this culminates for Harry and his immediate friends, Ron, Ginny and Hermione, in romantic love and child-rearing. There is a stark contrast here between the natural world of remorse and regeneration and Voldemort's efforts to hold on to his life at the cost of others. The contrast between Voldemort's hideous seeking of immortality by killing or maiming others and his refusing the natural course of regeneration and integration through remorse is almost the complete opposite of Harry's and Dumbledore's willing acceptance of moral, spiritual, and physical death for the sake of love and goodness. As becomes especially apparent in Deathly Hallows, physical death in Rowling's world is not the worst thing for a soul, or even the end of the soul. On the grave of Harry's parents, we read that the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. At first, Harry is horrified that this is a Death Eater idea, but Hermione explains that the reference is to living beyond or after death. Death itself might be a passage to something more. Seeing that Harry and Ron looked thoroughly confused, Hermione hurried on.
Look, if I picked up a sword right now, Ron, and ran you through with it, I wouldn't damage your soul at all.
Which would be a real comfort to me, I'm sure, said Ron.
Harry laughed.
It should be, actually. But my point is that whatever happens to your body, your soul will survive, untouched, said Hermione.
The death of Voldemort is desperate, unmourned, and ultimately pathetic. Tom Riddle hit the floor with a mundane finality. Whereas Dumbledore's death is integral to Voldemort's defeat. Moreover, all of those who bravely died in fighting Voldemort, including Dobby, Fred Weasley, Remus Lupin, Nymphadora Tonks, and Colin Creevy, were duly honoured and lovingly grieved. The Integrity Objection. One of the recurring objections to the idea that moral reform involves a radical regeneration akin to the dying and rising phoenix is that it undermines the integrity of personal identity. If you did some wrong, it is always and forever the case that it was you who did the wrong. No amount of renunciation can alter that fact. To imagine that you are somehow a new person after the grieving and the repentance invites a kind of self-deception. Imagine that I harm you wrongly and claim that this act was done by the bad Charles, but I am now the new Charlie, a fresh new person who has little sympathy with that old form of myself. This rebirth seems to threaten any kind of integrity I have with my identity over time. This critique of the regeneration model was advanced by the Freudian psychoanalyst Melanie Klein, 1882 to 1960. She held that personal maturity and continuity require that one keep a solid commitment to the fact that a reformed person is the self-same person who did the wrong in the past. An alcoholic, for example, usually still thinks of himself as an alcoholic, even after he has reformed and been sober for decades. The integrity objection thus strongly opposes the regeneration model. There is some force to this objection. The regeneration model can be abused. If one assumes